From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 30th day of August 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. A bit later in the program, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. And then we'll take up the agricultural cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Along the way, I'll update you on all the agricultural news for the afternoon. And then in the second half of our program, we call that the Farming World, we'll talk with Mosaic Company's Dan Fralick. He's their director of agronomy. It all happens on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to Cooley at admworld.com.
In Chicago on this Monday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby contract in the September wheat at 671 1/4, up 8 3/4. December at 704 1/2 for the soft red, 9 1/2 cents higher. Nearby hard red in Kansas City at 710 1/2 for the September contract, up 10 1/4. Back in Chicago from the corn pit, a 4 1/2 cent gain for the nearby September corn futures, $4.25 1/2, up 4 1/2 for the September. December contract, 441 1/2 in the corn pit, up 5 1/2, and the March at 454 1/2, up 5 1/4. May futures, 461 1/4, up a nickel. July corn at 467 1/4. 5 cents higher for the day. September beans at 10.18, down 4. November at 10.22 1/2, 3 1/2 lower. January at 10.31 1/4, down 3. And the March soybeans at 10.36, down 2 3/4 on the day. The May futures, 10.37 3/4, 1 3/4 lower. July at 10.44 3/4, down 1 3/4. September bean meal at 307.60, down 20 cents. September bean oil at 39.95, down 25. August live cattle at 97.25, 80 cents higher on the afternoon. September's at 115.10 in the feeder cattle. We're down $1.17 1/2. The October's there at 115.92 1/2. We're down $1.07 1/2 as well. And the October lean hog futures today, $74.87 1/2 for 100 pounds. They settled up a nickel. December futures for the lean hogs at 72.75 were 17 1/2 cents higher in Chicago at the CME Group. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, October contract, $74.70 a barrel, down 40 cents. September ethanol at $1.93 9/10. That's 1 3/10 higher on the afternoon. October natural gas up 10 9/10 of a cent to $3.81 4/10. And the RBOB at $1.93 2/10 is down down 1 5/10 of a cent, or 1 1/2 on the day. Diesel fuel or heating oil, $2.02 4/10 of a cent, down 1 9/10 for the afternoon. And the gold futures now, $1.50 higher, their settlement price at $1,237.10 an ounce. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,075, just about 75 points lower for the day. Here's what the weather forecast for the area looks like from the National Weather Service. They say this afternoon, a few scattered showers and thunderstorms should be around. It'll be mostly cloudy with a high near 84 degrees in Urbana-Champaign. South winds around 14 miles an hour with a few gusts up to 21 miles an hour. Chance of precip today, about 40%. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a low of 67. South winds at 10 miles an hour. Then tomorrow, mostly sunny skies, a high near 90 degrees. South-southwest winds between 8 and 17, gusting to 24. And tomorrow night, mostly cloudy skies, a low of 68. South winds between 7 and 10 miles an hour. On Wednesday, the rainfall may return. 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Mostly cloudy skies, high near 88, with winds between 7 and 13 miles an hour. And then Wednesday night, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Mostly cloudy skies, the low of 67. Thursday, another chance of showers and thunderstorms, set at 30% by the National Weather Service at this point. Cloudy and a high near 87 degrees. Partly cloudy on Thursday night, the low of 63. More on the ag news and weather when we get to the bottom of the hour.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. On the phone line with us, Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, to take a look at the futures markets. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
What was the squawk box saying about the trade in Chicago today?
Well, continued talk from, you know, last week, more confirmation. The yields here in the Central Belt, that is coming in less than expected. We're hearing, you know, 130 to 150. Quite common. There's some 180s, 190s, a couple 200s, but for the most part, producers are kind of disappointed or seeing these yields come in less than expected, and I think that's come into the trade here over last week and this week. We'll see how these yields develop here as we move along. There's going to be some better corn down the road, but it's going to be have to be awful good to bring up the average that we've seen here. Then, too, we saw some more investment money coming in. It's to the point now where investors are wanting to get into the action, and they have been. The key is tomorrow's end of the month, so we'll see if they, you know, see a little month-end profit-taking or not. Oftentimes, this money comes in the first of the month, but it's been there all month long, slowly coming in. One interesting thing, though, when we talk about investor money, the hedge fund position has actually gone down just a little bit here on the ownership of corn and beans, but the overall fund money, the trend followers who follow the shorter-term moving averages, has been the ones pushing the market, increasing their long position quite a bit here over the last 2 weeks, Todd.
Did that money move into the wheat market, or did it just disappear from the commodities?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not quite for sure on that, where it went to. I've mainly been tracking the corn and beans. The thing in the wheat was a huge, huge short position going into harvest and 1st of July, and ever since then it's sort of been liquidating the short position and building somewhat a long position. I just can't give you the breakdown on that one.
Okay, so let's talk about the corn market again. A couple of things that are coming out of central and east central Illinois over the past several days. There have been other crews out countywide usually looking at some numbers. Those are off from what I've heard by about 10 bushel to the acre. And then when you see the numbers, though, come in from plots, and I know they're plots, I see a lot of them come into my email, those numbers look awfully, awfully good. What's a farmer to make of all the information that they're probably getting in their email inbox at this point?
Well, yeah, I get the, we got a lot, we work with a lot of seed corn guys, seed salesmen, and nothing under 200, I don't think.
No, the plots never come in under 200. Well, unless it's showing somebody else's
seed. And they do a good job on their plots, and those yields are going to be high. And as long as you got good comparison, that's great. But actual yield data on some of these fields, hopefully it'll be good at some of these plots as we move down the road, just is not there. We'll continue to get reports as we move along in here. The thing is, I did talk to one producer, and he talked about guys going into the field, coming out for gunny sack, throwing the back white pickup truck and took off. Evidently, NASA's out taking surveys and samples and tabulating where we are going to be here as far as 1st of September. So it'll be quite interesting to see what the next crop report shows on the production side. Ideas are, you know, we're going to come down a couple bushels of corn at least.
Yeah, that's not too far off. If they come down a couple, you think the market can still maintain, and the market expects that, will it be able to maintain the levels that it's at, $4.41.5 today in the December, as we go through harvest and stay counter-seasonal?
We've done this in the past where we've gotten in the field, I think it's 2003, and the yield just wasn't quite there, especially in beans, and we maintain the gains. What will happen is the demand, we've got two things going on. We've got a supply-driven market, and we've got a demand-driven market, and both these stay intact. If corn yield comes down to this 162 bushel or lower, the futures are going to stay firm. Harvest pressure will probably be absorbed in basis, a wider basis, and that would be the way the market's probably going to handle that here, because we're still going to have over, well, at least I hope, over 13 billion bushels of corn for sale, and that's still logistic, plenty enough grain here to work with here as we go into at least the last quarter of this year.
Turn your attention to livestock. Nearby cattle down $1.17.5. The October down $1.07.5. Have they begun to top?
On the short term here, we found a top. When we go through August here, traditionally that's been a slow month. We're faced with Labor Day bookings that's been taken care of, so the big news here will be next week, see how this Labor Day clearance goes. We're still looking at the tightest cattle supply since the 1950s, so we feel that these fats, any pullback close to this 90-cent level is a good buy from an investor's point of view.
Kurt, thanks so much.
Very good.
Kurt Kimball is with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. I'll be back in just a moment with all of the agricultural news for the day.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In today's agricultural news, an estimated crowd of about 1,300 people attended the fourth of five U.S. Department of Agriculture and Department of Justice workshops to explore the appropriate role for antitrust and regulatory enforcement in American agriculture. The event was held Friday at the Fort Collins, Colorado campus of Colorado State University. The workshop, led by Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack and U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, examined competition in the livestock industry and featured panel discussions on trends in livestock, market consolidation, and market transparency. The workshop also included opportunities for public comments. In prepared remarks, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack said, given the consolidation that's taken place in the livestock industry over the past decades, it is now critical to ensure a fair market still exists to give all players an honest chance of success. Secretary Holder said ultimately about the conversation that it was much more than simply last year's trends or this year's challenges. He says it's about livelihoods, families, the region's economy, and a centuries-old American way of life. Holder says the livestock consolidation workshops are a cabinet-level priority to help ensure a fair, more competitive marketplace for producers and consumers alike. The National Farmers Union President, Robert Johnson, was at that workshop, and while the GIPSA proposed rule was a major point of contention, the focus of the workshop was on overall concentration in the livestock marketplace. Four companies, he says, control more than 81% of the total beef processing in the United States, allowing for non-competitive pricing to be forced upon producers. In 1980, there were more than 666,000 hog farms and 1.6 million cattle farms or ranches. Today, there are only about 71,000 hog farms and 950,000 cattle farms or ranches. Let's move from livestock animals to plant genetics. British scientists have decoded the genetic sequence of wheat. University of Liverpool scientist Nell Hall, whose team cracked the code, says the information could eventually help breeders of varieties of wheat better identify genetic variations responsible for disease resistance, drought tolerance, and yield. And although the genetic sequence remains a rough draft and additional strains of wheat need to be analyzed for work to be useful, Hall predicts it won't take long for his work to make an impact in the field. Now let's put the two together as we wrap up our ag news. Plant and animal laboratory tests have confirmed that the two Iowa egg companies that have recalled over half a billion eggs are contaminated with the same strain of salmonella blamed for a national outbreak of the illness, which has sickened at least 1,500 people. The confirmation backs up the suspicions of the Food and Drug Administration. FDA investigators detected the particular strain of salmonella in two barns at Wright County Egg and in feed that the company made and gave to its own chickens. The agency also found that same strain in feed that Wright supplied to Hill and Dale. Jeff Farrer, Associate Commissioner for Food and Protection at FDA, says these are the very first results, and there are many other results in the queue that may give us clues as to the extent of the contamination. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Next, did you know that governmental bodies have lists of weeds for eradication? Canada thistle's on that list, and it's a tough one to get rid of. I'll have some clues on how to do it. Canada thistle is a noxious weed. A noxious weed is an invasive species of a plant that has been designated by county, state, or provincial or national agricultural authorities as one that's injurious to agricultural or horticultural crops, natural habitats, and/or ecosystems, and/or humans or livestock. Well, Canada thistle is one of nine on the noxious weeds list in the state of Illinois. That list includes common ragweed, giant ragweed, marijuana, musk thistle, Canada thistle, kudzu, perennial south thistle, Columbus grass, and Johnson grass. Canada thistle is particularly a problem for organic farmers. There's some reasons why, says University of Illinois sustainable ag researcher Dan Anderson.
It's pervasive weed. It's a noxious weed here in Illinois. It's a perennial, very spiny, very thorny, has a beautiful purple flower on the top, grows in patches, and that's how you tell the Canada thistle, because it grows in patches. It can spread by seed, but it primarily spreads through the roots that creep out and send up shoots, and that's why you see it growing. You'll never see one alone. If you see one alone, that's probably the bull thistle. But the Canada thistle, you always see it in patches. And those patches will spread forever.
And therein lies the problem, especially for those that cannot or do not want to use a herbicide to kill the Canada thistle. Weed scientists at Illinois decided to tackle that problem and came up with a protocol that seems to work. Dan Anderson took that protocol on the road and put it to the test in the field. It works by disrupting the life cycle of the Canada thistle.
The life cycle of the Canada thistle is that it survives in the ground in the form of roots during the winter. In the spring, it will send up shoots from those apical buds in the roots. And during the initial part of the growth stage in the spring and early summer, it is living off the energy that it stored in the roots the year before, okay, until it flowers. Once it flowers, then it kind of throws a switch and it starts pumping energy back down into the roots. So early on, it's depleting the roots. After it flowers, it's rejuvenating the roots so that it can survive the winter and do it all over again in the spring. And so if you let that thing flower, it's gonna keep going and keep spreading. And what we've done is, and most people know this, that if you keep it mowed, keep it from flowering in the spring, what you're doing is you're forcing it to deplete the roots more and more. And so if you take that one step further and till it, let it grow, till it, let it grow, or mow it and let it grow and mow it. Keep doing that. And then in June, first 2 weeks in June, till it up good, and then plant a sorghum Sudan grass cover crop, real thick, 50 to 60 pound seed per acre rate. That Sudan grass then grows up and smothers out the rest of the roots, and we've gotten 90%+ of the patches doing that.
Now that means that patch, that land under that patch actually, must be taken out of production for the year. It is worth it, and interrupting the life cycle of the Canada thistle does kill it. For University of Illinois Extension,
I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. Jenny Springer of the Andersons from right here in Champaign County is on the phone line with us to take us through the cash grain markets. Good afternoon to you, Jenny.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, producers hauling any corn in yet?
We saw quite a bit of corn come in last week. We were, running a reduced drying to where guys were getting in the fields and, kind of seeing where moistures were at. We saw corn anywhere from 18.5% moisture upwards of 30% moisture. So kind of saw a wide spectrum last week. We haven't seen too much come in today. I think guys are just kind of waiting and letting it dry down just a little bit more in the field.
Did you take your reduced drying off as that was?
Yeah.
That might have had something to do with it, too,
yep.
I suppose. So they're satisfied that the corn is there, I guess, and that they can wait it out in the field and were early enough. When they were looking at their yields, what did they find?
They were finding stuff kind of across the board. I think as a general rule of thumb, it's maybe a little bit off of what they had last year. Some guys are thinking somewhere between 5 and 10 to 15%. Reduced yields from last year, but they also saw some record yields last year as well. So, I think they're going to be satisfied with what they have, maybe a little disappointed in some areas, but overall they'll still be happy with their crop.
How far along do you think soybean crop in the area is?
I think we've still got 2 to 3 weeks before we even see the first, couple loads of beans come in. We're just starting to turn in most of the countryside. I mean, if you hunt, you can find some bean fields that are, starting to drop leaves. But for the most part, it's just starting to get a yellow cast to it.
And where are your bids for the day and what's basis like?
Basis is getting a little bit weaker on the corn market. I think logistics and train movement is going to be an issue for everybody in every area, of the Corn Belt this year. For a cash corn bid, we've got 407. Fall corn bid 403, January 434. Cash beans were at 1032, fall beans 994, January 1006, and new crop wheat 610.
So you're only about 20, 25 cents under the January for the beans at this point. Is that what the basis normally would be in the area?
And I think, it's kind of a long shot right now. I mean, we've lost the processor over in Danville, so it's going to be, kind of interesting to see where beans will flow and if guys will store them and wait and move them, in the Jan, Feb, March time frame.
You said there was going to be some logistical problem getting trains. Why is that?
Just with the, the railroads already pretty much told us they're not going to perform as well as normal. They've got lesser fleets and, their crews. It takes 9 months to get a crew ready to go for a train, and they just didn't take the time or initiative to get those ready to go.
Okay, thanks so much, and
yep.
I appreciate you being with us.
Yep.
That's Jenny Springer. She's with the Andersons from... right here in Champaign County, joins us on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. Back in a couple minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's National Toasted Marshmallow Day. The use of marshmallows to make a candy dates back to ancient Egypt, where sap was extracted from the marshmallow plant and mixed with honey and nuts. But it was not until 1948 that marshmallows were manufactured in a fully automated way. On this day in agricultural history in 1812, Augusta de Mocha was born. A Hungarian businessman, he imported 1,400 varieties of grapevines to California in 1862. and he planted the first large vineyard in California in the Sonoma Valley. After a devastating blight destroyed much of Europe's vineyards, some of the same vines, now on resistant rootstock, helped rescue the French and German wine industries. He is also considered the father of California winemaking. On the 100th anniversary of his death, the 91st Congress recognized his contributions with an entry in the Congressional Record that read in part, "In a very significant way, he put California on the nation's economic and gourmet maps." In 1935, Sylvia Earle was born, an American oceanographer. She was the first woman to serve as chief scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the agency that, among other things, manages fisheries. And in 1939, Wheaties became the first cereal ever to be advertised live on television when Brooklyn Dodgers announcer Red Barber promoted it during a game against the Cincinnati Reds. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason, in with a look at the agricultural weather this afternoon. Mark Russo of Chesapeake Energy from Chicago, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Mark.
Good afternoon, Todd.
I see that we have a chance of rain this afternoon and tomorrow and maybe the next day. Not all that big, but better than average, 40%, 30% at least, according to the National Weather Service. Would you agree with them?
Actually, our coverage would be lower compared to the National Weather Service. For the state of Illinois and adjacent areas, the outlook on rain for any real significant totals, and with some of the dryness that's evolved over the past month, we're talking about totals above half an inch, and most you would like to see even more rain than that, but we would put coverage at only about 25%, with the northwestern portion of the state really being the area more favored than the rest of the state as far as totals getting over an inch. And a few popcorn showers and storms here today, tomorrow. The best opportunity still is coming up on Wednesday and on into Thursday. But really the bulk of widespread significant rainfall looks to be just west in areas like Iowa and into Minnesota. And then the western portion of the state, especially northwestern, at least in Illinois, having the best prospects for rain. But it's an opportunity for rain. Certainly rain is needed, but it could be better, Todd.
Indiana will stay dry?
Yes. And the further east you go, Indiana, Ohio, rainfall prospects look even poor compared to here in Illinois. So the pattern just features this one opportunity for rain this week. And the further east you are, the smaller your rainfall prospects.
Take me across the south and into the Great Plains states for the hard red winter wheat growing regions and tell me what they're setting up like for the sowing season.
Yeah, well, kind of a mixed bag at this time across the plains hard red winter wheat belt. Some areas have received good rains here in the past few weeks, portions of Kansas and Colorado, but then there's areas in Oklahoma and other portions of Kansas that have missed out on rain activity here of late. So overall, it's a mixed bag, and rainfall prospects for the hard red belt do not look all that good over the next week to 10 days. This Midwest or Illinois rain opportunity coming up middle of this week is also going to provide an opportunity for rain down south as the frontal system associated with this opportunity makes it into the southern plains. But again, rain activity looks more scattered and not enough to really solve some of the developing dryness issues across the plains hard red winter wheat belt.
And finally, take me into the other hard red winter wheat belt we're concerned about in Russia. What kind of rainfall might they get?
Yeah, across the heart of the Russia grain belt, we do not see any kind of significant precip over the next 10 days. Some of your minor producing acreage in the north have that acreage has received some minor rain shower activity, but has not been enough to solve the record-setting drought across that region. And so that remains a concern as we go into the new sowing season for Russia, especially as the next 30 to 45 days is the heart of their planting. And at least over the next couple of weeks, no sign of any major widespread rain events in that zone.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're welcome, Todd.
Mark Caruso is with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, and joins us here on the Closing Mark Report each and every Monday afternoon. Stay with us if you can. Our discussion during the farming world today surrounding fertilization. We'll talk with Mosaic's Director of Agronomy.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stewart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Dan Frelick, Director of Agronomy for the Mosaic Company, is on the phone line with us today. He's in a hotel room not too far outside of the Farm Progress Show site in Boone, Iowa, waiting for that show to start tomorrow. Mr. Frelick, thanks so much for being with us. Tell me about your job and what you do.
Well, I'm Director of Research for the Mosaic Company. If you're not familiar with the Mosaic Company, it's a fertilizer manufacturing company, mostly phosphorus and potash products. And I, as Director of Agronomy, I'm responsible for bringing new products forward, kind of premium products, and then helping dealers and their agronomists take that message to the farmer level.
Last week, Fred Belo on this campus at our Agronomy Day told the producers and the agribusiness folks that were here about a formula he had to come up with, 300 bushel corn. Actually, it came up to about 274. Our listeners heard about that. One of the things that he included, and he said it was included, of course, because your company asked and paid for this inclusion, was a proprietary product that is produced by Mosaic. It's a MAP product. Do you know what the product was?
It's called Micro Essentials FZ for sulfur and zinc.
And what is it exactly?
It is a ammonium dephosphate product, so it's, the analysis is 1240-0 with 10% sulfur and 1% zinc. What we do is we, as we manufacture the granule, we put both sulfate and elemental sulfur forms in the granule, and then also zinc, so that we get a lot better distribution of those nutrients, especially the zinc, where you typically put on 5 to 8 pounds of zinc, but the corn plant really doesn't need that much. It's really about the distribution.
So you're putting on less than that, but because you get better distribution with the more bulk product, it's the corn plant's capable of picking it up in the soils. Is that right?
Exactly. The studies that we've done comparing how much zinc do you need, zinc sulfate do you need to compare to the amount in our Micro Essentials SA product, and it's about 1 pound of our zinc in every granule equals about 5 or 6 pounds of zinc if you did it in a traditional broadcast application. If you think about the math, you're using zinc sulfate and you're using 5 pound actual zinc rate, you're putting 14 pounds of zinc sulfate in a blended with not quite a ton of fertilizer of, say, MAP, blend that together and spread it on the ground, you're probably not going to have very many zinc granules in any one spot. You know, they're going to be quite a ways apart.
Well, what are the health benefits of doing this particular broadcast of fertilizer in the fall?
Yeah, by having it in every granule, it's incorporated, so it's not an encapsulation, it's not a coating. And by having it in every granule, the dealerships that are handling this don't have to mess with the zinc sulfate, which isn't that hard to work with, but it's just less handling of the product. And then, from a fall application standpoint, it makes the process much faster for the dealer, as they're even if they're blending it with a potash or most pieces of potash product in the fall, they have one less thing that they need to incorporate in as well.
talk to me about fall application of fertilizers and why that's done. What's unique about this year in different geographic regions of the Midwest?
Well, fall application is done for a lot of reasons. One of the biggest reasons is to spread the workload with a either farmer applied or dealer applied. You can get across a lot more acres in the fall. It tends to be less wet in the fall than it is in the spring. So, and particularly this year, it looks like we're going to have a wider application window as we finish up. There are some areas that are already harvesting corn that, you know, two to three weeks ahead. So they should have more opportunity to get that old crop off, get their E&K applications down, and they'll be well ahead and more prepared for next spring. The other issue is when you go in the spring, you increase your risk of having compaction. So, you know, you look back just the last few years where we had very wet springs, farmers wanted to go out there and plant and do their tillage work and probably caused a fair amount of compaction. So you really minimize that chance of having compaction by doing it in the fall. Even if you do have some compaction, if it's a little bit wet when you're out in the fall, it has the freezing and thawing over the winter to be able to help break that up.
What do you expect producers will be asking you this week at the Farm Progress Show over the next 3 days?
I think the big issue is going to be how do we push our yields higher? And Dr. Below's been out talking about the high yield initiatives that we've helped with, and there's a group of people that are involved with that. And how do we achieve that? And I think probably more importantly, is it economically viable to push for that? How can they increase their odds of getting higher yields and minimize the risks that they have?
Well, Dr. Below, as he makes his presentations, talks about five all-stars, seven wonders that are sometimes under control of farmers, and five all-stars that they do have control of for the most part, two of which are twins, and in your area, fertilization, and in particular, the microessentials product, and then nitrogen. And maybe you can talk to me a little bit about the type of work that you asked that he do?
Yeah, we're trying to push for the ultra-high yield. You know, it's kind of been labeled 300 bushel in the farming community and with some other companies. We're just really after that ultra-high yield. And some of those factors that we had Dr. Below look at was a result of work that we've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years. And it started with nitrogen work, where we were looking at you know, that correlation between how much nitrogen you put on and your yield. You know, the 1.1, 1.2 pounds of nitrogen per bushel of corn is not a good correlation. It's kind of a shotgun when you look at the responses. The alternative to that we were examining was the delta yield nitrogen concept, where if you don't put any nitrogen on, you get 130 bushel corn. And you add more nitrogen and you get increased yield, that difference in yield is the delta yield, and then how much nitrogen did it take to get that. So that was the initial work that we had done with Dr. Below. And as we were doing that, we saw that some of these newer varieties, particularly the corn rootworm gene varieties, had a little different nitrogen response curve. So we expanded that out to the P&K side and measuring micronutrients as well. And then those kind of spun into how do we drive these yields much, much higher. So we're looking at the nitrogen side, adding what the university recommendations have at kind of the base level, and then adding in extra nitrogen, extra phosphorus. In our case, we're using our microessentials as the phosphorus source. And then also looking at plant population, the type of genetics, and using a fungicide or not using a fungicide.
Well, let me go through the seven wonders and then the all-stars, because they're all related. So the seven wonders that Dr. Belo talks about, if you've seen his presentations, and it's kind of fun to watch, include weather, nitrogen, hybrid selection or genetics, previous crop, plant population, tillage, and chemicals. Those are the seven wonders. And then what he calls the five all-stars are fertility, in this case phosphorus, and in your case the microessentials, but an extra 100 pounds of phosphorus, nitrogen at 100 pounds extra, genetics, once the rootworm, and true, he says triple stack, but rootworm in particular, as you outlined. Plant population, upwards of 45,000, and then also the use of a fungicide. So fertility, or phosphorus, nitrogen, rootworm, 45,000 on plant population, and also putting a fungicide on. You've looked at all that work. What do you think of it?
Well, I think, you know, what we're trying to do is keep the nutrients balanced, first of all, and then raising that yield goal up. And the nitrogen source, when you're applying that additional, we need some form of slow-release nitrogen. We want it available later in the season. Most farmers really don't want to make an extra trip across the field, and there are some that are set up to do added nitrogen applications through their irrigation systems, but that, unless you're in the West, that's kind of a minority. The phosphorus side, we've kind of surmised for years that we're not adding enough phosphorus for the kind of yield levels that we're pulling off. We're basically using the same rates that we did when our corn yields were in that 130, 140 bushel range. And most of the recommendations that are made from soil test labs, from universities, that work was done 30, 40 years ago when those yields were lower. And then you throw this new genetics on top of that, and it really makes a difference. So we feel that we need to be applying more than we currently are of phosphorus anyway, and this has kind of proven that. Having the sulfur and zinc in every granule with a microessentials product, actually, we get some synergies on nitrogen uptake efficiency and also phosphorus uptake efficiency. So we're getting a lot stronger growth. I think Dr. Belo labeled it an NESZ effect, kind of a starter effect in the spring with the trials that he had. Those young corn plants were 6 to 8 inches taller than the traditional type work. So, you know, we are getting some synergies among those nutrients that are working. The plant population, if you kind of do the math, it's really tough to get 300 bushel corn if you don't get your plant populations above 40, probably more like 45 or maybe even 50,000 plants per acre. That poses some problems in 30-inch rows that we're working on as well. Dr. Bill, I know, is working with some twin row, and also we need to look at maybe 20-inch row things as well. The corn rootworm trait, you maintain those roots are much healthier, a lot more root mass than what we've seen in the traditional varieties, and anytime you have more roots like that, root hairs, you increase your odds of getting those nutrients pulled into the plant faster. The use of the fungicide, we do care about the fungicide from the disease aspects, but we also care about the fungicide from the growth regulator components that are part of that fungicide. So the kind of the key thing that we found with this is if you just change one of these factors in a traditional practice, and that's what's usually done, so you take you only increase the plant population, but you don't change anything else, you can actually make your yields go backwards. So it's kind of a whole system approach, and these five factors that Dr. Belo is working on, they can help compensate for each other, and they interact with each other. So you need to raise that whole system and not just one or two of those components at a time.
We're talking with Dan Frelick this afternoon. He's the director of agronomy for Mosaic Company. More here on The Farming World in a moment.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
Here's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
Edamame, also known as vegetable soybeans or edible soybeans, are gaining in popularity as a new crop for Illinois. And because this unique vegetable provides a complete protein, they're a great option for vegetarians. Some U of I researchers believe edamame is a good candidate for the expanding food production system in Illinois. It's the same species as grain soybeans, so it's a logical crop for Illinois, seeing as Illinois is one of the top two soybean-producing states. Because it's a newer crop in Illinois, more research is needed on agronomic practices to produce it more efficiently at the commercial level. U of I soybean breeder Dick Bernard has taken a first step by crossing large seeded Asian varieties of edamame with adapted U.S. grain varieties, resulting in a promising vegetable-type soybean, garden soy, that grows well in the United States. Garden soy varieties are available to home gardeners for spring planting free of charge from the National Soybean Research Center. And that's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
Something of Interest is a public service of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
You're listening to The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking with Dr. Dan Frelick, Director of Agronomy for the Mosaic Company. He's outside of Boone, Iowa, awaiting the start of the Farm Progress Show next year, and graciously decided to talk with us this morning about fertility practices. When we left you, Mr. Frelick, we had come through the discussion of some of the five all-stars. You mentioned nitrogen a couple of times, and I heard you say, and I don't think that I've made this very clear when we've talked about it on the air here, that you wanted that to be later available later or later release. I know that in Dr. Belo's experiments, I think most of them, the idea was that there'd be 100 extra pounds of nitrogen, but that it was side dress. So it's not that you're putting extra nitrogen on in the fall, which might not be a very good thing, I suppose, for the environment.
Yeah, what Dr. Belo did was he was using an extra 100 pounds of nitrogen. He did it in the spring. It wasn't really a side dress application. He did it, I believe he did it, at time of planting, but he used a controlled release nitrogen and he had done some experiments with it, with all the sources that are available, and he said they were all pretty much equal, but he selected one of them, which we tend to use any one of the forms depending on where we're at in the country. So the key is to have that nitrogen become available later in the season. You can do that with a slow-release, controlled-release product applied in the spring, or you could do it with side dress, but I think we'd still prefer to have a control release, even if you did it by the V6, even up to the V8 stage. It would be better to still have a control release nitrogen product to slow that up a little bit.
Also, you mentioned twin rows or 20 inches. You think that'll be important with the plant population up around 45,000?
Yeah, we're actually evaluating plant populations up to 55,000, and we're using twin row technology to do that. It's really, you have to get that spacing between the plants. We want to maintain a good stalk diameter. And so we've been experimenting up to 55,000 in twin rows. In 30-inch rows, we can go as high as 42 to 45,000 plants per acre without having standability issues. But the twin row is nice because it plants kind of a diamond pattern. Those rows are about 7.5 inches apart. And we get a couple things with that. One is a lot better nutrient utilization. We put the fertilizer between those two 7-inch rows, and that root growth is right in between those rows. Plus, we tend to get, when you do have rains or even very heavy dews, that corn plant's kind of like a funnel, and it pulls that water, it gathers that water, and it goes next to the roots. When you have twin row, it channels it between those two rows. So even though between the 30-inch row may dry out, it tends to stay the water longer between those rows, so the plant can tolerate things a lot longer. So we're looking at twin row, but the plant population needs to be high in order to physically get that kind of yield. Using 55,000 plants per acre, you may get half-pound ears instead of the traditional two-third-pound ears that you're used to. So they may be a little smaller, but when there are that many of them out there, the yields really add up.
And one other note, if a producer tries to do some of this work themselves, they can't really just add one of the things, because what you found, and I know what Dr. Bilo has found, is that sometimes yields go backwards if you take one of these and drop it in rather than pushing yields up. They all sort of have a synergy and work together.
That's exactly right. Plant population is a good example of that. There have been a lot of studies where people have kept their same nitrogen phosphorus applications, didn't change variety, and they go up to 45,000 plants per acre. In the studies that we did, we lowered yields 15 bushel by doing that. When we added in more of this high-tech system where we had all five high-tech components, we raised yield 15 bushel. So that's a 30 bushel swing. Fungicides are kind of the same way. If you're at 32,000 and you don't have disease pressure, use a fungicide, you're probably not going to get a very big response. But when you get in this high-tech system, you pick up another 15 or 20 bushel by using the fungicide. So all these components are kind of work that way, that you just need that higher level of management across the board for them. In the case of the phosphorus, the added phosphorus that we put on, when we just substitute the phosphorus source, use our Microessentials SE versus a MAP or ADAPT, we typically, over the last 9 years that we've been evaluating the product, we see a 7 to 8 bushel yield increase in corn. When we put it in the high-tech system with all these components, that difference is in that 16 to 18 bushel range. So you need everything to make it work well.
And finally, I'd probably be amiss if I didn't ask you about this while I've got you on the phone. What's the discussion within Mosaic about Potash Corporation being purchased and the opportunities or problems it might create for your company?
Well, I don't know that it would create a lot of problems. Our business is kind of as usual. We're expanding our mine capacity for potash production, as is Potash Corp. There have been a lot of rumors about people buying out Potash Corp in the past, and there were rumors a year or two ago about a company out of Brazil trying to buy Mosaic. So I don't know that it's really going to have a big impact. If it happens, it'll happen, and I don't think it'll change the story for the American farmer very much. The potash is in Canada, so it's going to make its way into the U.S. No matter who's kind of behind it.
Dan Frelick is Director of Agronomy for the Mosaic Company. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.